I remember a few years ago in a newspaper an article saying the sacred cow in India was a huge problem because it prevented more automobiles being sold. Because the cow is sacred, it roams around the roads. And as long as cows are roaming around the roads and they're cyclists and they're pedestrians, you know, there's a limit to how much advantage you have of having a car. The only difference between walking or riding a bicycle and having a car is you're free in one and you're locked in aluminium in the other. I call it the prison of metal. But when you can clear the roads off of the cyclist and the pedestrian and the cows, then you can speed it. And of course, that's the American dream. A political party lost the last elections in India because it turned superhighways and driving fast as the ultimate symbol of India. And it was a stupid move because they actually hired a US advertising company to fight elections in India. And this company said, you must have the slogan of Shining India for the election. Now, this is in a country where I mentioned 25 written languages, thousands of spoken languages, English spoken by a little minority. So Shining India, which said, and now you can drive fast on a highway and drive like the Americans do, didn't go down well with the peasants whose land was being appropriated to make those 8-lane highways. It didn't go down too well with those little retailers on the streets who were being bulldozed off because they were coming in the way. These are called cleaning operations. The city is getting cleaned up of cows and people. Unfortunately, elections are one time where people count for votes. They're usually forgotten in between elections. But that time they do count, and the dispossessed in India were bigger than those who were shining. Our population of cars has increased 500% in the 10 years of globalization. We used to be, I loved the Indian landscape because we had only two models of cars. We had the Ambassador, as it was called. Any of you who've been to India will remember. 15 years ago, the tough Ambassador, you could load 12 people into it. It could go on rough roads. And the other was a very old model of the Fiat. And then globalization happened, and you can get every model of every car. But those old cars used to be owned by 4% of India. The new cars are still owned by 4% of India, except now 4% owns many more. So when General Motors says, oh, Indians are getting more cars, and suggesting that the American dream is being shared by the entire world, what you're not being told is the American dream is becoming a new indulgence for very narrow elite. I call it the 5% economy. And that 5% is then trampling on the rest. Because if America with its 20% requires 80% of the planet's resources, then multiplying that model means 80% of every country's resources end up going moving up to the elite. I would therefore call the current model of globalization the ultimate enclosure. You remember the enclosures that happened in England? This was basically taking the land of the peasants so that on the land could be put sheep, which would then produce wool to feed into the new mechanized textile industry. And in those days, it was said, sheep eat men. Many of the uprooted people of that time, through the enclosures of the commons, became the early settlers of this continent. Nova Scotia is named after the clearances called the Highland Clearances of Scotland. People just brushed aside. Well, it's similar clearances happening today. Last night, Carlo gave me this fat book, and I was going through some of the removals, literally removals of Native American tribes. Well, there's a grand removal happening in the world today. And that is the reason why this promise of prosperity that globalization is supposed to bring actually turns out into a curse of dispossession and a curse of poverty for large numbers of people. What are the vehicles of corporate globalization? They are financially the World Bank and IMF, that structures into its debts and loans conditions that say you must liberalize your economy. And the word liberalization, I believe, is very, very misleading because for people, it's not being liberalized. It's being liberalized for corporate investment. The second instrument is the World Trade Organization, created precisely to turn the world into a grand marketplace, a marketplace where everything is a commodity. My own work in this area started because 1987, I'm sitting in Geneva for a meeting at the United Nations. The biotechnology industry has just started to emerge, and it is a new mutant of the chemical industry. And they're sitting around, the Ciba Geigys, the Sandozes, they're also the same people who are the pharmaceutical industry. And they're sitting around and talking about how they need a new set of rules, a new institution that will force every country to patent everything from seeds to medicines to software. They need markets that will ensure their products, the genetically engineered products, are the only things available in the market, because non-genetically engineered seeds every peasant can produce. And then they go on to talk about how if they have to get to the stage where they need to get, because for them to not be super, super, super big is a huge problem. In fact, they said by the turn of the century, we will be 5 corporations controlling all of health and all of food. And for them, it was a problem if they weren't going to be among those 5. That as giants, they were too small. And since that meeting, I'll just give you some examples. There used to be 4 independent giants: Ciba Geigy, Sandoz, and Astra and Zeneca, 2 separate ones. Sandoz and Ciba Geigy became one in Novartis, then the 4 of them became one, and they're called Syngenta. Monsanto made its name, basically means the sacred mountain. And I remember driving once, I was coming out of Siena in Italy, and 4 o'clock I was being driven to the airport, and I seen the sign, it says Monsanto, and I say, my God, they're here too. No, it was the name of a little place, a little village called the Sacred Mountain. Probably Mrs. Monsanto came from there. Well, their only record was chemicals for warfare, Vietnam, Agent Orange. And then suddenly, in this period, 2006, they are the biggest seed company of the world. A company that grew out of no experience in farming, no experience in living with the land, no experience with biodiversity or food production, today controls the food production of the world. So Monsanto today has bought up every seed company, all the family seed companies, all the domestic seed companies, and controls the largest number of patents in the agricultural field. In fact, when the World Trade Organization was finally ratified and institutionalized, a Monsanto representative went on record to say, in writing this agreement, which is the agreement called Trade-Related Intellectual Property Rights, heavy word, would suggest nothing to ordinary people, but what basically is about owning life on this planet. Intellectual property is now a grand word that combines patenting, breeders' rights, trademarks, secrets, design, everything in one big bucket, and treats living forms, microorganisms, plants, animals, as the inventions of corporations, and hence the private property. So the removals that started in colonialism, which were about removing people from territory, are now grand removals that are removing from evolution the capacity of life forms to evolve into the future. And this capacity is being interrupted by 2 means: the property rights, called intellectual property, and new technologies. In terms of intellectual property, I talked about the agreement that was brought into the trade agreement, and when countries like India said, but this is not about trade, they just went back to Washington and put TR before IP and said, now we've defined it as trade-related, and therefore we will negotiate it within a trade agreement. And we will force every country of the world to recognize property and seeds. Now, seeds to me are the ultimate commons. the ultimate commons, because they have millennia of evolution embodied in that little potential, but also millennia of the future unfolding of evolution in it. Within the seed is all the culture that went into that seed. I know for you it's the season of carving out the pumpkin, but you know, all those pumpkins have come out of little seeds. Different shapes of pumpkin, different sizes of pumpkin. Little seeds that Native Americans would have saved, evolved, domesticated, selected. And all of that cultural embodiment is also resting in those seeds. So it's a commons biologically, and it's a commons socially, in a sociological sense. And to be a commons means to be shared. That's what being a commons means. That which belongs to a community. That which is not private. That which exists for the common good. That's the commons. Now, seed, the ultimate commons, is being enclosed. And it's being enclosed through the patenting. And what does a patent mean? A patent first means I have invented life. And you might remember there was this thing of Dolly, you know, the sheep, named after a Dolly in your part of the world who used to sing Dolly what?
Dolly Parton.
Right. And why did they name a sheep after her? Because she's going to be producing in her milk human proteins, because they've genetically engineered her with a human protein. And they clone her. And they declare this to be the second creation. And they call the scientist who produced. He didn't create the sheep. All he did was take a cell and remove the nucleus and put another nucleus and put an electric shock through the cell. And in one case out of thousands, it actually fused. And through the fusion, Dolly grew, but she didn't last too long. She's now stuffed in a museum because, you know, no one knew exactly what her age is. Was it the age at which the cell was taken out, or was it the age when the cloning happened? In any case, she was called the second creation, and Ian Wilmot was called, the one who gave an electric shock, was called the second creator. You know, I think there's kind of an ontological confusion going on. But when you claim to have created and invented a seed, and it's your intellectual property, that it being on someone's farm and the farmer growing it out is basically suggesting that when the farmer saves their seed on their own farm, they are now stealing. Now, in the hands of women, and most of the world, seeds are in the hands of women. Elderly women are the seed keepers. They are the ones who keep the seed, evolve it, save it, select the best. There are rituals about selecting seed at harvest time. And that's where food security has grown. If you look, any of you interested in your own history, look at how grandmothers put seed into the hems of their skirts when they moved from Europe. How seeds came from all over the world. And that's what enriched cultures. As long as seeds were in women's hands, they were a common. They were shared, they were saved. Now, sharing and saving is a crime. So when I fight for farmers' rights, I'm fighting against the criminalization of one of our deepest ecological duties on this planet, to save seeds for the future. And I don't just fight for farmers' rights, we save seeds. This movement I started, Navdanya, which means 9 seeds, but it also means the new gift, is basically a movement to keep seeds in women's hands. We create community seed banks. We collect seeds, rescue seeds, grow them out, share them, and constantly declare to the government, saving seed is our highest duty. Therefore, violating your patent law is our highest duty, because we were very blessed to have Gandhi. And Gandhi taught us that if you have to defend freedom, then you have to learn to distinguish between just law and unjust law, moral law and immoral law, and you have to have the courage to not cooperate with immoral and unjust law. That's also what Martin Luther King practiced in this country when racial laws were perpetuating injustice. So Gandhi had walked out and collected salt from the beach when the British were trying to make it a monopoly, and said, we will make our own salt. You cannot prevent us from making our salt. And we, like him, do the seed satyagraha. Satyagraha means the struggle for truth. We do the seed satyagraha and we say, We will make our seeds, grow out our seeds, share our seeds, gift our seeds, spread our seeds, and not let them go extinct. Because not only is there this criminalization through law, there's this criminalization through technology. The human mind, which should be dedicated to the service of protecting biodiversity and life forms on this planet, is getting dedicated on how to annihilate life on this planet. The wars that are being fought over oil, the wars in Iraq, the wars in Afghanistan, and it had nothing to do with 9/11, it had nothing to do with Al-Qaeda. They could never work these connections out, but it had a lot to do with oil. And the wars that are being fought over oil have already given us the kind of experience of the loss of freedom in every society in the name of creating democracy. But the worst kind of destruction of freedom is coming out of technologies that come out of that war mentality. They are literally products of a militarized mind. And something like the Terminator technology, again, the patent of this is owned and controlled by Monsanto, trying to buy the United States Department of Agriculture, controls this technology that would make seed sterile. It would, through genetic engineering, unleash a lethal toxin just when the embryo is forming, kill the embryo so that when the farmer grows out the seed, he doesn't get a plant. And this is one way to grow the market. $1 trillion a year. $1 trillion a year by forcing farmers to stop having their own seed supply. This is not freedom. This is dictatorship. And globalization, because it's pushing this kind of dictatorship, is becoming the basis of deep new poverty. There are three areas where poverty arises. There are three causes of poverty. Nature is not a cause of poverty. Nature gives enough for all our needs. The Native Americans were not poor till they were dispossessed and thrown into the reservations. This land was their land. They might have not dressed in impressive suits like Carlo, but they were beautifully dressed in their distinctive clothing. And of course, today, I mean, it's called skins when they wore it, and it's called furs when the models wear it. And of course, I mean, just look at their bodies. Shining, radiant skins, health speaking out. So poverty was not the condition of cultures living with nature. Poverty is a condition of cultures uprooted, removed, thrown out as garbage. That's where poverty begins. Poverty gets deepened when communities taken off their best resources, their best land, their best forests, are then having to also suffer to live with the waste of industrial global capital. And it generates a lot of waste. It's very efficient, not in using the resources of the earth. It's very efficient in generating piles of toxic waste. And of course, in this country, all the studies show that miraculously all the waste ends up where people of color live, where poorer communities live. And it's not an accident that the goods of the earth, the resources of the earth, are mined wherever they are. Yeah? It could be the oil created from biomass of millennia ago, turned into fossil fuel. It doesn't matter where it is. It comes to where the wealth is. And it doesn't matter where the pollution is generated. It goes wherever poverty is. I filed a case. There were two toxic waste ships coming sailing from the United States, coming to India for waste disposal. But we have a Basel Protocol which prevents trade in toxic waste. So I filed a case in our Supreme Court, and the judges said, "Are you suggesting they're treating us like a garbage dump?" I said, "Jolly well, Your Honor." And they immediately said, "These ships won't land." Because the ambassador was then at the environment minister's house saying, "You've got to let these ships come in. Because it's cheaper to send shiploads of waste far away to India than to recycle it and treat it here. So you've got a one-way flow of the resources of the world." And, Dino Kay is from Nigeria, I was told.
Yes, I am.
well, look at all your oil and where it's traveling, and Ken Saro-Wiwa, a dear colleague and dear friend, was sacrificed, as with many others, just so the global corporations, oil companies, can keep mining the oil from the Niger Delta, the Middle East oil, doesn't matter where the oil is, and where it comes to the waste, throw it back at people who have been rendered powerless. And that's the second reason for poverty. And I believe the third reason of poverty is what we are seeing under the unique features of the current model of corporate globalization, the commodification of every aspect of life. If your seeds are commodified and they're no more your common resource, you go to buy them every year. They're going to be costly, because built into the cost of seed is a super, super, super rent. Landlords used to collect rent from land. The life lords collect rent from life. So as a seed grows out on a farmer's field, the Monsantos of the world still want to collect rent. They're called royalties. And I'll give you the case for cotton. Genetically engineered cotton was introduced by Monsanto to India in 1998, illegally. I also have a case on that one. They get the seed. The seed costs only 300 rupees for a 400 kilogram, 600 rupees. And when I'm talking 600 rupees, $10. $10 is the cost. But they sell it to the farmer at 4,000 rupees. The rest is a monopoly royalty. And there's a case against Monsanto now, which we filed on this monopoly. And the monopoly is not just that they are collecting super rents, but they've destroyed every other seed supply where they enter, so farmers won't have the ability to turn to their own crop. As I mentioned, this means a huge growth in market for Monsanto. Look at the amount of money they make. But where is that money coming from? Farmers are being made poorer. And as farmers are made poorer, what happens? And farmers are made poorer by two processes linked to corporate globalization. One process is the rising costs of production. Seeds become more costly. The seeds you need chemicals. The chemicals are costly. The more you need, you spray chemicals, the more you need them. Every year you need to buy a new seed. All of it adds up to a huge costly package. Meantime, because agribusiness in this country is subsidized heavily, $4 billion just for cotton, and then that cotton is dumped on world markets. The price of cotton is 50% lower than what it took to produce. And that is lower than what domestic prices are. So African cotton growers lose their markets. Indian cotton producers don't earn enough. The price falls to half. The cost of production jumps up 10 times, 100 times. Farmers are squeezed in unpayable debt. A very new experience for a country like India, which has 70% people in rural areas, unlike in this country, where the numbers are so small they don't count anymore in the census. And the result of it is the most generous, fulfilling economic activity, that of growing of food and working with the earth, is turned into a fatal activity. Farmers of India have started to commit suicide on rates that are unimaginable. We didn't have farm suicides before economic globalization. The first farm suicide I counted was 1997. And since then, we've been bringing out this annual report. It's gone so fat because the names of farmers who are taking their lives keeps increasing. It has reached 140,000 farmers, concentrated in the areas where the new seeds have come and where agriculture is integrated to global markets. Farmers growing their own seeds are not committing suicide. Farmers working with us have actually doubled and tripled their incomes and doubled their output through ecological means, which also totally counters the idea that unless you industrialize agriculture, unless you introduce genetically engineered seed, you can't feed the world. In fact, the only way you can feed the world is protecting biodiversity, farming ecologically, making the soil come alive again, and working on small farms where love and care can be given to the land. And our data, and we've done 20 years of studies on this, we just produced a report, and these can be downloaded from our website, which is navdanya.org, N-A-V-D-A-N-Y-A. This report, we've gone ecosystem by ecosystem, and everywhere the small, biodiverse, ecological farm produces more food and higher incomes for farmers than the monoculture chemical farm can. The only productivity that's higher in the industrial farm is the so-called productivity of labor. But what is the productivity of labor? It's basically counting how much fewer people you need to produce a certain output. It doesn't measure more output. It merely measures fewer people in the workforce. So in fact, it is a measure of displacement and unemployment. And it has wrongly been talked about as a measure of productivity. Because humans are not the scarce element on this planet right now. We are abundant. We don't have to limit our input. What we have to limit is the input of water. We have to limit is the input of minerals. What we have to definitely limit in this period where oil is running out, 2007 is the peak oil period. After that, it's going to be a downturn. There'll be oil depletion. And it's a non-renewable resource. We knew it all along, should have remembered it. We've treated it as if it's a renewable resource and will carry on forever. And built bigger and bigger cities, fatter and fatter automobiles. I've just for the first time had a Humvee experience. You know, these tires that are meant to roll over you and crush you to death. I think the guy was honking, and I think he was giving the suggestion, if you don't move out, you're crushed. And you know, I think it has to do something with the sense of insecurity that drives the macho spirit. You know, I in fact think globalization comes out of that kind of spirit. I think it's coming out of highly insecure men needing to feel that unless they control the world, they're not secure. Why can't you just be secure living in your own limits? And of course, when you have that level of insecurity and you have that level of grab and you have that level of greed and you have that level of monopoly, you have to always pretend you're doing it for the good of the others, you know? Which slave owner said he wasn't owning the slave for reasons other than the welfare of the slave? You know, every colonization was justified as liberation. Every domination has been subtly redefined as the liberation of the people. Iraq, remember, it was supposed to have been Operation Iraqi Freedom. And they love it so much, look what they're doing. But what this project of violence, and it is a project of violence, it's not just the wars we recognize as war, but every economic activity is becoming war. Producing food is becoming warfare. The seed has become a zone of warfare, and even the sad bottled water has become warfare against the planet. That's why I have my brilliant prink borrowed from the DeFazio family. Out of the tap. 2002, I was invited by a tiny group of women to a village I had no idea about. But they were celebrating 1 year of fighting coke. And I decided to go down because I like to lend support to movements. So I flew in to Coimbatore, drove 3 hours to this little village called Plachimada in Kerala. And Kerala is the southernmost state of India. When the rains come, that's where they deliver their bountiful water. It's a region not short of water, abundant rainfall. And Plachimada is, in fact, the rice bowl of that region. Coca-Cola set up a plant, and within a year, their water was running out. Coca-Cola was pumping out 1.5 million liters of water per day. 1.5 million liters. According to the United Nations, our normal entitlement for living a decent life is 40 liters. You can divide 1.5 by 40 to see how many people's drinking water and other needs were being taken away. But it isn't just the water that was being taken away, and of course the water table was going down, but they were in addition polluting the water. And now we are doing tests on the different sites of the Coca-Cola and Pepsi-Cola plant. And it turns out on every plant, the water has heavy metal residues of cadmium, chromium, lead. And I think part of it is coming from the fact that they use toxic ingredients. I don't know how many of you, you know, those of you who are Coke and Pepsi addicts, You know, it gives you this thing, the whole thing they sell is fun, you know. And when they got into problems on their health impacts, they said, but we never did sell health, we just sell fun. But the ads are about. Enjoy. But what you're enjoying is phosphoric acid. That's what gives you the tingle. Now, phosphoric acid, as you know, is an industrial acid. It's an industrial ingredient. It's used to wash paints. And when that mixes, and they, of course, load it with paints, you know, the bottles, when it's washing off lead, it's washing off some of these heavy metals. Since their production process is a trade secret, nobody really knows how they're managing to pollute so much water. But what we do know is wherever there is a plant of Coke and Pepsi, there is water scarcity in India today. And it was these amazing women, starting with a woman called Mailamma, a 60-year-old woman, who they started to go further and further to get clean water. And one day she said, why are we walking longer distances? This plant should shut down because the water in our wells should stay clean. And she called a group of women of the village together and they said, we'll shut this plant down. They set up a tiny little hut opposite the gate. And I went to celebrate 1 year of protest with them. They continued. 2 years ago, the plant was shut down. 10 women started it. And that triggered a nationwide campaign, that now, since then, I found there 90 plants of Coke and Pepsi, each of them mining 1.5 to 2 million liters a day. And if they carry on at this rate, they will have created huge water scarcity in places which did not have water scarcity. And we have a campaign. It's called very simply, Coke, Pepsi, Quit India. Both because we made them quit India in 1977, and life did not stop without them. But also because with them, we have, on the one hand, a huge problem of water scarcity for village communities. And we believe water is a commons. We believe water belongs to the public, and we believe it. The courts have recognized it. In fact, there's a brilliant court ruling of the High Court of Kerala by Justice Balakrishna. And he said, water is not the property of a company. It is not even the property of the state to be given away to a company. It is the common, he doesn't use the word property, it is a common resource of a local community. And therefore, the state has only one relationship, which is as a public trustee to protect the water and to prevent its pollution and depletion. So it's in fact countering this other principle, which is called the eminent domain principle, that the state can take what it wants and hand it over to whichever monopolizer wants to grab hold of our water, our land, our minerals, our oil, our forests. And this reclaiming of water as a commons is extremely important, because when we have less clean water in our wells and our streams and our rivers, and there's less water to be shared, and everyone is drinking water at 12 rupees a day, and 12 rupees per bottle, because you need about 5 bottles a day in a hot tropical climate, you're that much poorer. You know, they keep using this figure of a dollar a day, that poverty is about living on less than a dollar a day. You can be fine at a dollar a day if you don't have to buy everything in your life. Yeah. Your communities are strong, your forests, where they are forests, not in the desert, but forests are good. And in the desert is kind. And the deserts can be kind too. In fact, in India, we have the Rajasthan desert, which is the most populated desert of the world. And the conservation of water out there is brilliant. It's absolutely amazing. Every drop is harvested in 100 millimeters of rain. They still farm. They conserve every drop to then grow a crop. They have beautiful tankas, beautiful technologies. I hope some of you will travel to see some of it, to come and see our farm where we run a school. I run a school called the School of the Seed, basically because I like to see the seed as a teacher, both as a teacher of renewal. We are the renewal of our own potential. And to me, that's the ultimate experience of freedom. That the conditions of our freedom, the conditions of our life, are not in the corporate headquarters of Shell and Exxon or Monsanto or Coca-Cola. The conditions of our life and the conditions of our freedom are in the abundance of the earth and our ability to know our own potential to be economically productive. What is the ultimate push of this project of globalization? to let 70 to 80% of us believe that we are disposable. We don't matter. We don't count. We are historic rubbish. We are like that toxic waste, waste to be dumped. And on the other hand, for 15%, the marketplace, to buy, 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 buy. And since you can't buy too much if it's too costly, you make it all very cheap to buy more and more, and therefore the Walmart model becomes the ultimate model of a globalized economy. Exploit the workers in China to produce cheap jeans, exploit the workers here in whatever these things are called, because I don't like to call them shops. They don't have any of the experience of a shop. Exploit at every level. Exploit democracy, because they force themselves on societies by manipulating one or two politicians. That's what they're trying to do in India. They're trying to enter these days. We are in Walmart is coming kind of phase in preparing. But to do that, they must destroy the local retail. And when we talk of local retail, we are talking about every little inch of the street. We are talking about people pushing a little cart and coming to your doorstep to give you the vegetables for the day. The milk vendor who comes to your doorstep, turn the corner, you've got a marketplace full of women selling, 400 million people selling and buying, many of them women. But that small retail is coming in the way of Walmart. So they're trying everything under the sun, cleaning up cities, removing street vendors, just like they removed the cow for the automobile, and even shutting down. I mean, Delhi right now is in the process of shutting down commercial centers so that when Walmart establishes, everyone goes out of the city. Except, like I said, only 4% of India owns cars. What will the rest do? Walk? Walk those many miles? Now, the water privatization market is another $1 trillion. Seed market is $1 trillion. Water privatization, $1 trillion. I haven't even begun to talk to you about food. But destroying local food economies and making people dependent on food grown somewhere else and then processed somewhere else is the source of a huge increase in profits for agribusiness. But it is at the root of malnutrition in the world. And there are two forms of malnutrition and new forms of food poverty we are being hit by. In countries like India, in regions like Africa, the poverty comes out of throwing people out of producing food, or even when they grow food, they can't access it because they borrowed for chemicals, they got to sell the food, and then they buy it back, it's 4 times more costly. So they can't buy back enough to eat. They grew enough to eat, but they can't buy back enough to eat. So the biggest number of hungry people of the world today are producers of food. Hunger used to be an urban phenomenon. It has become a rural phenomenon. 1 billion people permanently hungry. And add to it another 2 billion people suffering another kind of malnutrition, the malnutrition of obesity, of food gone wrong, food that doesn't match our bodies, food that totally destabilizes our metabolism and leads to the epidemic of diabetes and everything else. It is the world's biggest disease today. Food-related disease. The World Health Organization tried to bring out a report on it. Agribusiness, junk food industry, soft drink industry organized in the United States to say, you will not release this report. But everywhere in the world, as this American diet moves, with it moves food-related diseases. Now, so whichever direction you look, the more growth takes place, the more poverty increases. And it could be sector-wise, could be in every region. India, as you know, is shining these days, 8.5% growth. They want to hit 10%. Malnutrition has increased in the 10 years. There are more hungry people today than there were 10 years ago. Dispossession has increased. Poverty counted in terms of how are people living has increased. And with it goes this other dimension of how insecurity then fuels that divide and rule policy. How diversity in cultures turns into the raw material to play people against each other in order to maintain control. I won't go into too much depth in this, but I have 2 new books that touch on it. One is called India Divided from Seven Stories Press, and the other is called Earth Democracy from South End Press. And both of them go into much, much more detail about the convergence of the three phenomena of our times: ecological devastation, the growth of inequality and injustice, and the spread of violence and the destruction of conditions of peace. This violence, I believe, is the place which connects violence in the economy, violence in the way our societies are being permeated by violence, and the use of violence as an instrument of control of the planet's resources. This violence, for me, is patriarchy operating on a global scale. And if we have to build an alternative, and we are building an alternative, whether it's growing food or water harvesting or recovering the commons, in every one of those aspects, what is really face-to-face with each other is a world in which we see ourselves as part of a planet with limited resources, needing to share them. And that spirit of sharing, to me, is the feminist ethic. It is the womanly ethic. And on the other side, a patriarchal vision based on fear of everything alive, basically saying we've got to control, we've got to exclude, we've got to use violence and force, and it doesn't matter how much destruction it will take. But our security has to come first at the cost of all other insecurities. That search for security is false, and we again have to just look at Iraq, that it is in fact fueling higher and higher levels of violence and higher and higher levels of insecurity. But the most important thing is the other way is so much more joyful. It produces so much more. We have to overcome the idea that we are born into scarcity, that the earth creates scarcity. Earth creates abundance. The earth is not empty. The earth is our mother. She is Terra Madre. Thank you.
Dr. Vandana Shiva, Indian activist and environmentalist. Thanks to the LA Sound Posse for that recording. The LA Sound Posse records presentations of importance and distributes them freely in order to be the foundation of a democratic civic media. To find out more about the LA Sound Posse, visit them at lasoundposse.org. We'll conclude the program with the next installment of John Taylor Gatto's Underground History of American Education. This book is the result of more than a decade of research in which Gatto sought to understand the reasons for what he observed in his decades as an award-winning teacher in New York City, that school was not improving the minds of the nation's children, but instead creating psychologically damaged people who couldn't think and couldn't read. We continue now with Chapter 8, A Coal-Fired Dream World. Gatto writes, "Think of coal mines as vast experimental laboratories of human behavior, testing the proposition that men, women, and children will do virtually anything, even allow themselves to be consigned to damp, dangerous tunnels under the ground for all the sunlight hours, in order to have real work to do as part of the community of mankind. If the American Revolution could be said, as the Declaration held, to demonstrate a self-evident truth, that all were endowed by their Creator with certain inalienable rights, the coal revolution tested the contrary proposition, just how far those rights could be taken away if exchanged for work. Work was shown by this unworldly occupation to be of value as necessary to human contentment as liberty in the pursuit of happiness. In lieu of alternatives, people would indeed bury themselves alive to get it." I just want to interject here that I find this paragraph bizarre. Obviously, people do despicable work because their choices are that or starve. And continuing, "And coal was a continuous, highly visible object lesson about just how thoroughly the concerns of unseen outside interests could be imposed on childhood. For over a century, the best profits had come from using young children as coal miners. By 1843, when Horace Mann visited coal-dependent Prussia to gather background for his seventh report, boys and girls between the ages of 5 and 8 were at work in every coal mine in America. 50% of all coal miners were children. Children were employed as trappers to open and shut the doors guiding air through the mine, as fillers to fill carriages as grown men knocked coal from the seams, and as hurriers to push trucks along to the workers at the foot of the shaft. In some places, trucks were pulled instead of pushed, and little girls were employed as pullers because their small size was in harmony with the diminutive tunnels, and because they were more dependable than boys. An excerpt from a Pittsburgh newspaper of the day is instructive, quote, "A girdle is put around the naked waist, to which a chain from the carriage is hooked, and the girls crawl on their hands and knees, drawing the carriage after them." One quiet stream in my own family background was the McManus family from West Elizabeth, Pennsylvania, Irish immigrants in the 1840s. Census records list some of them as coal miners. My grandmother was Moss McManus before she became Moss Simmer. She never talked about the past or recalled a single ancestor except one, a McManus licensed as a Mississippi River pilot in a document signed by Abraham Lincoln, which still floats around somewhere in the family. "What of all those coal miners, Moss? No memories for your grandson?" I suppose the answer is, she was ashamed. Coal mining was something that ignorant shantyboat Irish did, not a fit occupation for lace-curtain Irish, as Moss tried so hard to be in the face of long odds. Long after the owners of mills, mines, and factories had abandoned piety, except on ceremonial occasions, miners would pray for the strength to endure what had to be endured. Their children would pray with them. Here are the words of a little 8-year-old girl, exactly the age of my own granddaughter Moss as I write this, who worked as a coal miner 100 years ago, worked perhaps for the famously civilized Dwights and Peabodys of New England. "I'm a trapper in the gamer pit. I have to trap without a light, and I'm scared. I go at 4 and sometimes 3:30 in the morning, and I come out at 5 and 5:30. I never go to sleep. Sometimes I sing when I've light, but not in the dark. I dare not sing then." Isn't the most incredible part of all the fact that she could write so eloquently with no formal schooling at all? The year was 1867. A newspaper of that year observed, quote, "Chained, belted, harnessed like dogs in a go-cart, black, saturated with wet and more than half naked, crawling upon their hands and feet and dragging their heavy loads behind them, they presented an appearance indescribably disgusting and unnatural." The confinement of American children to warehouse schools less than a half century later had been pioneered by the Massachusetts experiment we associate with Horace Mann in the decade just before the Civil War. No other state followed Massachusetts' lead for a long time, but everywhere children were engaged in mining and factory work. In Massachusetts, the essential practice in confinement was underway, a prelude to universal acceptance of schooling as the natural burden of childhood. Schools were the antimatter twins of mines and mills. The latter added children to the labor market. Schools subtracted them. Both were important functions of a new centralized command economy. By 1900, direct child labor had been rendered unnecessary by the swift onset of mechanization, except in those anomalous areas like theater, carnival, advertising, and modeling, where special pleading to keep children at work would succeed during the general campaign to insulate children from common life. and I'm reading from John Taylor Gatto's The Underground History of American Education. By 1905, industrial corporations employed 71% of all wage earners, mining enterprises 10% more. At exactly the moment forced schooling legislation in America was being given its bite by the wholesale use of police, social service investigators, and public exhortation, corporate capitalism boiled up like sulfur in the Monongahela to color every aspect of national life. Corporate spokesmen and academic interpreters, often the same people, frequently explained what was happening as a stage in the evolution of the race. A Johns Hopkins professor writing in 1900 said that what was really happening behind the smokescreen of profit-making was the sifting out of genius and the elimination of the weak. Close quote. The leading patent attorney in the nation, speaking in the same year, said nothing, including the law, could stem the new tide running. The only realistic course was acquiescence and adjustment. Charles Willard of Sears and Roebuck was the speaker. Willard suggested the familiar American competitive system is not necessarily meant for all eternity. Business was wisely overthrowing competitive wastefulness, which produced only panic, overproduction, bad distribution, and uncertainty, replacing it with protected privilege for elected producers. The principles of the business revolution, which gave us schooling, are still virtually unknown to the public. Competition was effectively crippled nearly a century ago when, profoundly influenced by the doctrines of positivism and scientific Darwinism, corporate innovators like Carnegie and Morgan denounced competition's evils, urging the mogul class to reconstruct America and then the world in the cooperative corporate image. "Nothing less than the supremacy of the world lies at our feet," said Carnegie prophetically. Adam Smith's competitive, self-regulating market would be the death of the new economy, if not suppressed, because it encouraged chronic overproduction. Henry Holt, the publisher, speaking in 1908, said there was too much enterprise. The only effective plan was to put whole industries under central control. The school industry was no exception. Excessive overproduction of brains is the root cause for the overproduction of everything else, he said. James Livingston has written an excellent short account of this rapid social transformation called Origins of the Federal Reserve System, from which I've taken some lessons. Livingston tells us that the very language of proponents of corporate America underwent a radical change at the start of the century. Business decisions began to be spoken of almost exclusively as courses of purposeful social action, not mere profit-seeking. Charles Phillips of the Delaware Trust wrote, for instance, "The banker, the merchant, the manufacturer, and the agent of transportation must unite to create and maintain that reasonable distribution of opportunity, of advantage and of profit, which alone can forestall revolution." It hardly requires genius to see how such a directive would play itself out in forced schooling. In 1900, in his book Corporations and the Public Welfare, James Dill warned that the most critical social question of the day was figuring out how to get rid of the small entrepreneur, yet at the same time retain his loyalty to a system based on private enterprise. The small entrepreneur had been the heart of the American Republican ideal, the soul of its democratic strength. So the many school training habits which led directly to small entrepreneurship had to be eliminated. Control of commodity circulation by a few demanded similar control in the commodity of production. To this end, immediate sanctions were leveled against older practices. First, destruction of skilled worker craft unions, which up to the Homestead Steel Strike in 1892 had regulated the terms of work in a factory. Inside a decade, all such unions were rendered ineffective, with a single exception of the United Mine Workers. Second, professionalization of mental labor to place it under central control also was speedily accomplished through school requirements and licensing legislation. In the emerging world of corporate newspeak, education became schooling and schooling education. The positive philosophy freed business philosophers like Carnegie from the tyranny of feeling they had to always hire the best and brightest on their own independent terms for company operations. Let fools continue to walk that dead-end path. Science knew that obedient and faithful executives were superior to brilliant ones. Brains were needed, certainly, but like an excess of capsicum, too much of the mental stuff would ruin the national digestion. One of the main points of the dramatic shift to mass production and mass schooling was to turn Americans into a mass population. And I'm reading from John Taylor Gatto's The Underground History of American Education. Older American forms of schooling would never have been equal to the responsibility coal, steam, steel, and machinery laid upon them. As late as the 1890s, the duration of the average school year was 12 to 20 weeks. Even with that, school attendance hovered between 26 and 42% nationwide, with a higher figure only in a few places like Salem, Massachusetts. Yet America had to be massified, and quickly. Since the end of the 19th century, American government and big business had been fully committed, without public fanfare, to creating and maintaining a mass society. Mass society demands tight administration, close management to an extreme degree. Humanity becomes undependable, dangerous, childlike, and suicidal under such discipline. Holding this contradiction stable requires managers of systematic schooling to withdraw trust, to regard their clientele as hospital managers might think of potentially homicidal patients. Students, men under military discipline, and employees in post offices, hospitals, and other large systems are forced into a condition of less than complete sanity. They are dangerous, as history has shown again and again. There are three indisputable triumphs of mass society we need to acknowledge to understand its strength. First, mass production offers relative physical comfort to almost all. Even the poor have food, shelter, television as a storyteller to raise the illusion of community. Second, as a byproduct of intense personal surveillance in mass society, to provide a steady stream of data to the producing and regulating classes, a large measure of personal security is available. Third, mass society offers a predictable world, one with few surprises. Anxieties of uncertainty are replaced in mass society with a rise in ennui and indifference. And I've been reading from John Taylor Gatto's The Underground History of American Education. John Taylor Gatto was an award-winning teacher in New York City schools in 1991 after being named New York State Teacher of the Year. He very publicly quit the profession, announcing he no longer wished to continue hurting children. He's since become one of the nation's foremost advocates of homeschooling and self-directed education. You can download this book and find out more about his work on his website, johntaylorgatto.com, G-A-T-T-O. And you can download an MP3 or podcast of this and previous episodes of Unwelcome Guests at our website, unwelcomeguests.org. Our theme music, Unwelcome Guest, is performed by Billy Bragg and Wilco with lyrics by Woody Guthrie. Thank you for listening.